Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Hello. Cole Hornaday.
Hello.
Hello. And Chris Casso.
Hello.
How is everybody today?
I like your new greeting. Hello.
Hello.
Well, great.
Our side of the table is very festive.
So festive.
Yeah.
Nicole's got her emerald hair and her emerald eyebrows and her Santa cap, and I have my red turtleneck.
We're all black.
Why'd you downplay the red turtleneck, man?
Well, actually, and she also has her lips. Her lips are painted the same color as actually my turtleneck and her Santa cap. So anyway,
we're coordinated.
And then from the dreary side of the table,
the bah humbug. The color scheme on this side is Iceland.
Yes,
blue and black.
Black and blue. Mm-hmm.
It's Seattle because you never know when it's going to be like randomly warm, and then like the mist rolls in and it's freezing.
I think we can trust now that it's just going to be uncomfortably cold for us. For our people.
There has been lots of mist, but that winter sun is brutal, man. I swear to God,
dude,
it's blinding.
I'm like pulling up to intersections and I cannot see because it's
I'm
right
blinded.
Right in the sclera.
Yeah.
Blinded right. By the light.
Well, so this is the first show that we're recording after our fantastic Panel Jumper Live Chapter 5, which happened on December 8th at West of Lennon. And I just want to say a big thank you to everybody here at the table for coming out, for Cole Hornaday for spearheading most of that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we had a terrific time with Kazu Kibuishi, and he was we were successful. I was successful at actually recording the show.
Good.
I listened
a lot
to it.
Of awesome things to share.
Yeah. And it's funny, the time on the live show podcast, time goes by really, really quickly, because I told the stage manager there, or no, the house manager, that I was only going to be 10 minutes, and the final podcast ended up being 20 minutes. But I think it's really, really fascinating. Look for that come the new year in 2018. It should be out in January of 2018. One of the things that I was proselytizing was during this holiday shopping season, go out and support your local comic book store. And I put my money where my mouth was.
Yeah,
and
I did.
Bought a whole
Thank
bunch
you.
Of comics here.
So can
from
you
the
clarify what you're proselytizing doing at the live show?
It's a
cool thing at the live show.
So what I did at the live show is I actually asked people, we had a live audience recommendation corner where I asked people who they wanted to buy gifts for and if they wanted to buy comics for gifts, and then I asked them to describe this person they wanted to buy a comic for, and Chris and Nicole gave great recommendations, and I wrote down...
Except when I gave a recommendation for something I can't actually get in the store, which was Princeless Volume 1. Yeah, that was bummer.
Well, they're not going to know that unless they come into the store. And while they're here, they might actually buy other things, because there was more than one comic I wrote on the back of those cards.
Manager Mike, if you watch the Panel Jumper, you know who Manager Mike is. He did come in and buy some things, and he did want Princeless. So I have failed him.
Oh. All right, and so it was a great time, and the Panel Jumper film that we showed at the show is now live at thepaneljumper.com, issue 6, EC Come, EC Go. Check it out and share it with all your friends. And finally, one last bit of business. We are contractually obliged to publicly thank people on the podcast that the week the episode airs from our lovely Patreon account. If you want to support us on Patreon, please go to thepaneljumper.com and click the big, huge, large Patreon button. And we don't need to applaud for them here, but if you're at home, just clap for these people, for the names I'm about to
list. Golf clap. Give it some bigger.
All right, please give it up for Daniel Christensen, Mark Brewster, Nick Reichar, Webster Polk, Brian Howard, Jessamyn Bateman Iano, Stephen McCandless, Lauren Dudley, and lastly but not leastly, Mr. Manager Mike Gilson. Thank you all for your support. We really do appreciate it. And oddly enough, I do not know every single one of these people, so that's a new
that's good.
That's a
new also
term.
You can see Webster in Easy Come, Easy Go.
You can see
Webster. He's just like in the background sitting there staring.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
He's not staring. He's an extra and he's committed to his moment.
Hey, Webster, I need you. Just go sit in the audience. All right. Hey, friends, let's just start the show for reals.
Okay.
Now, it's December 18th, the week this episode drops, episode 149. We are so close to the holiday shopping season. In some cases, we are already past it. And I want to know, what kind of deals do you guys have here at the Comics Dungeon?
So we are going to have an end of year sale that starts on the 27th. And it's going to go to the 2nd. And we're actually putting it together right now. But one of the big discounts we're going to have is on back issues. We're going to do 70% off back issues, 75% off if you're a box customer.
Crap, that's a lot.
It's a big one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will also have big discounts on toys. We will have discounts on all the trade paperbacks in the store. We will probably have a bunch of dollar bins and a bunch of 50% off book bins. We're gonna kind of throw in a few extra things as we get closer to it, but that'll be the big blowout for us right now.
And we do have an event posted on our Facebook page, and so you can see all the updates as they come out on our Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right. So check out Comics Dungeon on Facebook. Link is in the description of this here podcast. Or come down, if you're in the Seattle area, come down to Comics Dungeon at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford. All right, friends, let's talk about a little bit of comics news. Now, this isn't actually breaking news, but this broke like immediately after we wrapped recording on our last batch of podcasts. But Marvel's new editor-in-chief, C.B. Cebulski, has been found out. He was illegally, and I say illegally because it's against Marvel's rules to use a pseudonym as an editor to write comics. Hmm. But he was writing under the pseudonym Akira Yoshida, and he was suspected of being this character all the way back from like 2004.
And denied it.
And denied it initially. He finally copped to it after he accepted the EIC role at Marvel. But the fact here isn't that he was writing under a pseudonym. It's that he was pretending to be Japanese.
No.
And created an entire persona.
Well, there's some multiple layers of falsity here that make me really uncomfortable. And I think it behooves Marvel to stop and reconsider how this reflects on their corporate culture. Because, you know, do you really want people seeing you that way, that you're just, you know, you hire liars, that you hire people who don't have a second thought about appropriating other cultures, you know?
There was an interesting counterpoint in the article that, because one of the, I forget her position, but one of the heads of Marvel was pointing out that, like, he's been born and raised in Japan, and uh-huh. I mean, like, he lives in Japan, okay. And everything, so he's not necessarily speaking falsehoods throughout it. The identity thing too was kind of people trying, or them pointing out, like, it can be really crappy trying to get into the industry sometimes, mm-hmm. and he was just trying to do everything he could. Not that that forgives him all, but somebody, the person that was speaking about it was somebody that I did value what she was saying.
Okay.
She came from a position of really pushing for Marvel's diversity. She is a person of diversity. So it's just kind of one of those, like, okay, well, you're going to bat for him. I don't think we need to hit him as hard on this, mm-hmm. but boy, that does suck. Because mm-hmm. it's like the moment he took over, it was just like, oh, we found something horrible you did.
Yeah. And on top of it, I think the thing that made me feel a little icky about it was just his like rebuttal to it, just seeming so nonchalant, you know, just being like.
I do believe he said, well, I was young.
Yeah. And I learned a lot from it, and but not a big deal. It's all resolved, and it's like, well,
let's try this hat on. What if a person of color had done something like this? What if a person of color had written as a white person?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that person probably wouldn't work again. Mm-hmm. There would be a pretty horrific backlash, I would think. So anyway, just putting that out there.
He does use that as an excuse where he was young. He kind of got caught up in it. He didn't mean to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe he didn't mean for it to go as far as it went.
Exactly.
So, and I can understand that. You think like you're just going to do something and kind of go under the radar and maybe get something. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, wow,
And he wasn't original. I mean, the fact that he was writing as Akira Yoshida was, you know, you have that opinion, if you will. But he originally wasn't going to use that persona in a Marvel book. But Marvel wanted Akira Yoshida's voice, and that's how he got caught up in it.
Right.
And the subterfuge this guy went through to hide it is pretty impressive. He actually hired a Japanese translator to pretend to be Yoshida visiting
Marvel offices. High-octane baloney right there. Yeah. And I'm using the word baloney because of children in the audience, but I'm sorry.
Oh, I would bleep you.
Yeah, will you? Yeah. Okay, then that's high-octane bull right there.
Oh, you just gave him more work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he didn't.
This is premeditated. This wasn't like, oh gosh, I got caught up in the moment and I'm a father. It's not the same.
Right.
And then the stork was at my window.
Yeah.
Door? Mm-hmm. Where do they come from? Where do they go to?
He had to think about this.
Anyway.
He had to put some planning into this. I'm sorry, I cut you off. But
I was lost in my stork analogy.
Twitter gave him the what for. Okay. He's not going to lose his job.
That's unfortunate.
And he's probably not ever going to do that again.
Right.
So, one would hope. All right. So moving on, here's a little bit of interesting news that why do we care? I don't know, but I put it in anyway. John Hamm is gunning hard to be the new Batman. A lot of people think Ben Affleck is on his way out because of the reception of the Justice League movies. No confirmation has happened yet, but still, John Hamm as the Batman. What do we think of that?
I'd rather not. I just don't know. I mean, he's a terrific actor. He's a terrific actor. But
I feel like you and I maybe are torn, Chris.
Why do you feel that way?
No, I think
better than Ben.
Better than Ben.
Yeah, but that doesn't take
better
much
than
time.
Val.
Yeah,
better than
George Clooney.
Yeah, way better than George. But I was thinking of somebody else I would rather him be.
Who got it right in your eyes? We've had plenty of actors play Batman, but who got it right beyond
Kevin Conroy?
Beyond Kevin Conroy.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well played.
I'm okay with what's his bucket?
John Hamm.
Nolan Batman.
Yeah.
Christian Bale.
I'm okay with Christian Bale. Because I always feel it doesn't hurt to have a little bit of psycho in your Batman.
Right.
Yeah. I thought he had a fine performance, but you know, the voice thing always pulled me right out of it.
It's a little jarring.
On the flip side, he's given us so much material to have joy with.
Yeah.
That voice.
But those movies are so well done, it's kind of like I let the voice thing slide.
Yeah. But Kevin Conroy was the first one to do that. It actually
the dark
says
voice thing.
To separate the voice between Batman and Bruce Wayne.
But what Bale did was
he took it to 11
to Cookie Monster.
So
thank you.
Who are you?
So affected.
I love crime.
I remember when I walked into the second movie and all the things are happening, and then he turns around, looks in the camera, and says his first line of the film, like, "Oh, I forgot how awful that was. I seriously had blocked it out."
I forgive it because it gave us that one sketch of Batman finds his voice, which if you've never seen that, go Google that right now. It's a college humor or something.
Batman finds his voice. The article here, adventuresinpoortaste.com, has a photoshopped picture of John Hamm's face on Batbody, and it looks like a villain. I think he looks like a villain wearing the bat suit.
I would want him to have... There's two other characters I'd rather he be, and one of them would be Maxwell Lord. If you ever read Justice League from the Giffen to Matthias run, Maxwell Lord started as a good guy, but kind of a shallow, horrible business guy who funded the Justice League. But later on, he became a full-on villain. And he is, John Hamm is him, like the embodiment of him, as far as I'm concerned.
Though Sam Neill was the original face of that character.
Yeah.
Mark McGuire used Sam Neill as the model back in the 80s. So when you first saw when you first saw
Maxwell,
Max Lord, yeah. He looked like Sam Neill.
The other thing is that that picture you showed, he does look pretty evil. There's yeah. a villain, there's an anti-Batman called Prometheus. I'd actually love to see him be Prometheus now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Somebody online, one of the message boards I read said he's better suited as Mr. Miracle. What do we think of John Hamm as Mr. Miracle?
Yeah, that has possibilities, sure. Yeah. But after reading the current Mr. Miracle book that Tom King and Mitch Gerards are doing, I actually see Scott Free as a much younger man. Mm-hmm. I yeah. see him like in his late 20s, early 30s, maybe.
Really?
Even. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
But
more.
because we will get to that when we get to our top five discussion down the road. But yeah, that's, it has possibilities, but he's got to have a lighter heart than Hamm.
Okay, so if you guys have ever watched 30 Rock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He played a love interest yeah. to...
Tina Fey,
and really? He was a bumbling idiot.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I've not really seen much Mad Men, so when I read that on the notes, I saw this bumbling, like, handsome doofus, and okay, I was like, right. I can't see him as Batman. Well, so you should just watch those episodes.
Okay, in Mad Men,
and you will feel so lighthearted, because he's like this handsome doctor, and he's just a doofus.
But he gets by because he's so handsome.
Because he's yes. so handsome.
Right. I had to give up on Mad Men because it just got, after a certain point, I think it was in the middle of the third season, and the misogyny and the self-loathing that these men wallowed in just got to the point where I couldn't watch it anymore. And I actually started seeing this as indicative of everything that's wrong with capitalist culture, that this was like blowing it all open, and I'm like, that was too much for my brain and my heart to handle. So I
think
I could
watch you take TV shows way too goddamn serious.
You're darn right I do, but somebody's got to do it, Ben Lawrence.
He immerses himself so far, he is like in the trench. What's the trench? The yeah. Marina Trench or whatever. Yeah.
Shocked.
John Hamm, he's only 46 years old, which kind of surprises me, but it shouldn't, because he's actually a classmate of a friend of mine from college, and I have friends who have taken acting classes with John Hamm, which is kind of interesting. Hmm. It's fun to think about. All right.
He wouldn't be a bad Tony Stark.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
I mean, we're so ingrained with the Downey Stark,
yeah,
but
yeah. Right.
But if there ever had to be a different thing, yeah, he wouldn't be the worst.
RDJ will never let that role go.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can totally see. I couldn't see John Hamm with Tony Stark's facial hair, though. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, speaking of the Justice League movie, it's having ramifications. There's a big shakeup over at Warner Brothers DC. John Berg is currently the comic books film production, the head of the comic books film production division, and he's leaving that, so the job's open if anybody wants it.
I don't think I have the experience.
He's still staying with the company. But yeah, it's. I thought it was funny.
Do you have a pulse?
Whoa.
Jeff Johns might be stepping into that role. We don't know. But Justice League was made for $300 million. It's only made $500-some million. But, of course, they're comparing themselves to the Avengers, which
It's made ridiculous amounts.
Billions. Yeah, like yeah. 1-point-something billion
yeah,
dollars.
It's yeah, it's huge at this point.
Is that,
look
what
it up.
Is that what's happening with Jeff Johns? Is he going to move on over into an executive position at Warner?
I could believe something
and
like that happening.
We could get him out of the cubicle, and he can stop writing lackluster comic books. Is that what is that going to happen for us?
It might be in his future.
That would probably be for the best.
Nobody's saying anything about that, but that's
I'm
what the speculation
plenty.
Is.
Anyway,
so has anybody here seen Justice League?
No.
All right, but Bill's around the board.
But hey, I did see Thor Ragnarok. I'm a little bit behind now on that one. Has anybody watched Punisher yet?
No.
Yeah, we are just way so busy being creative and bringing joy to the people.
Well, there's also a billion things to watch.
There's a billion things. It's like I do feel like I need to sit down and watch at least one episode of Inhumans. I do need to watch Runaways and. Do we have a New Mutants show, too?
It's a movie coming out.
Oh, okay.
There is a New Mutants.
Gifted?
Gifted, yeah.
See, I haven't seen any of these things. And thanks to Ben Lawrence, now when I go to parties, people turn to me and go, hey, Cole, have you seen such and such? And I'm like, nah, no, I haven't. Well, you're the comic book guy. And I blame Ben Lawrence. I curse him.
You love it.
You set the foundation and then you ingrained it in a friend who could then pass you off. So you've got a, like a like a wingman thing happening.
Hangs the crown, people.
Now you know how I felt at certain parties.
Exactly. I can't imagine. Right.
Also, what I see on boxofficemojo.com, it's $1.5 billion for Avengers.
Yeah. That's counting overseas,
but that's everything. Yeah. That's domestic and foreign.
But that's also, isn't that Avengers like year to date? And that movie came out in 2010, 2011?
Yeah. 2012. At a certain point.
2012?
Yeah.
Yeah, so,
so it's,
I mean,
its opening weekend was $200 million. Domestically.
Yeah, see, that's the problem with what Warner Brothers DC is doing. They're like, well, Justice League's been out for 2 weeks and it's only made $500 million. Avengers has been out for 5 years and it's made $1.5 billion. What's wrong with us?
There was a really interesting article I read, I think at Forbes, that broke it down every aspect of they had to guess because they weren't, they assumed 300 million, but last time I checked, Box Office Mojo still didn't know how much went into the movie.
Yeah.
But they also tried to take into account base numbers and base math that they had for the cost of advertising and kickbacks and all this other stuff happening, and assume kickback to the different actors and all that stuff. And I think by the end of it, they're like, they're going to make like 50,000 profit, or no, they were negative 50,000 by the time they did the math.
Hollywood math is a famous thing.
Yeah. So that was like, ooh.
It's, you know, I can't remember what movie it was. I think it's Return of the Jedi. Technically, has never turned a profit, just because of the way Hollywood does math
for the studio.
I don't know the specific.
George made a lot of money, and he continues. Well, he doesn't anymore because he sold them all to Disney.
Why did you become way ish all of a sudden? Right. Matchmaker. Okay, anyway.
You're singing my song, baby.
I know.
You're totally singing my song.
So IDW has canceled G.I. Joe, Scarlet Strike Force before it's even come to the stores.
Mm-hmm.
And some people think it's amid a tweet controversy by the author, I believe.
Yeah.
The world we live in, a tweet controversy.
I know, right? Yeah.
And I don't think it's that at all.
Yeah, I mean, there's this article.
Happened. Go ahead.
It was on September 11th, and it was kind of a snarky tweet.
Did you read? You want to read the tweet?
Do you have it in front of you?
I have it in front
of me.
All
right, go ahead.
Yeah, because I actually did some research on this one, much to everyone at this table's chagrin. Citizen said, in reference to the 16th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on New York City, he said, oh good, it's self-centered national tragedy remembrance from people who weren't even anywhere near New York City Day. And I read that and I took offense at that because I didn't know why that person felt so entitled to be so nasty. And I'm like, oh, are you telling me that I can't feel anything about this event or even acknowledge it? I respect the fact that he's saying something like, you know, thoughts and prayers and how fruitless and that is. But the thing about social media and the thing about posting stuff like this on Twitter is that after all this time, I don't think people actually stop to consider the impact that their words are going to have. Because I just read that and I was like, I would never buy one of your comic books again.
Well, and the problem is text is always open to interpretation.
Of course.
And when you just leave some small blanket statement, it can be interpreted 1,000 different ways.
Right. But
and people either be offended or they'll be like, oh, I don't understand why that's such a big deal.
Sure, but then what is the point? What is the point of putting those kind of words out there? What are you seeking to accomplish by doing that?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm totally down, especially because IDW did their best to separate themselves from it.
Sure.
But the focus point of the rest of the article was that there was a really crappy contingent of humans that are like anti-SJW and very, very, very douchey about their approach on that, that they're the ones that are kind of pushing for taking this guy out.
Okay.
And so that's the... It's become two separate problems in my eyes.
Got it.
And that's why it makes it kind of like a little infuriating, because this is a book that was never going to sell, period. We ordered two copies, and the article makes a note of like, It's normal for on the FOC, the final order cutoff, that they do the math, they figure it out if it's worth it, and there are books that get canceled at the last minute because it's just not worth it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And nobody, I think, really cares about G.I. Joe to this extent that it's worth the extra effort from IDW. Mm-hmm. So it's two different problems based on a non-factor problem for
me.
Like,
okay.
We shouldn't be caring about this. Because this happens in the industry,
but my gut response is, why is that even necessary? When why is it? Why are those words necessary, especially now? And that, of course, that person's nastiness is based on their experience and how they interface in the world with the world. All well and good, but we see so much of it right now. And I'm like, why?
So.
Why?
Yeah, this guy, Aubrey Sitterson, didn't have a lot of fans to begin with. And then that tweet wasn't, it was actually the first day. The first day he tweeted it, it pretty much went unnoticed. And then a G.I. Joe fan site picked up on it. And they were like, let's not buy anything IDW sells with Sitterson's name on it. And it snowballed from there. And like you said, it's not uncommon for this to happen.
No.
And they probably expected it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But this has happened with other people
practicing unwise discourse over Twitter, and it's destroyed their lives and their careers.
No one
seems to learn.
I'm all for people destroying their careers via Twitter.
Well, also maybe they just don't have, you know, like they have a inner bubble. I mean, I post every once in a while on Twitter, and nobody looks at it. Nobody cares. So it's like, because I don't really do anything to build that up.
I have a klaxon alarm set up. Whenever you post, oh baby, the lights go on.
Really?
As a no.
Okay, exactly.
As a public persona, you do have some sort of responsibility to your employer.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yes.
So, but as a person expressing their opinion, that's what Twitter's for. And if you tweet something and you suffer the backlash from it, well, you know, think a little harder next time. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move on.
Yeah.
So I actually got this from the Comics Dungeon rant I get every Monday morning in my inbox. Woo-hoo! It's a list of all of Marvel's upcoming events, despite their promise to stop. We don't have to go through all of them, but it's just another instance of Marvel not doing anything right.
Yeah.
It's more like, Marvel, you just didn't get it, did you?
Yeah.
Marvel. We don't know how to pick up the clue phone.
Yep. Yeah.
There were six of them or seven?
Yeah,
I
think I stopped reading them at one point. So Phoenix Resurrection is one that's coming out later this month. Mm. Avengers No Surrender in early 2008. They Hold Infinity sometime in February. There's a Doctor Strange one called Damnation. And it just kind of goes on and on. Wedding of the Century. Who's it going to be? Nobody knows. Does anybody care? Let's move on. Yeah. Oh, and that was the last one.
They get divorced a month later. Hey.
Yep.
Yeah.
So... yeah, it's Marvel. Oh, Marvel! You just kind of want to pat it on the head and tell them they're trying as hard as they can. Yeah.
Unfortunately, the pat might become a smack on the back of the head.
Yeah.
All
right, and I thought this was interesting. The rumor has it Quentin Tarantino is going to direct an R-rated Star Trek movie. Now, they don't know, like, what continuity, what the plot is, what era, why do we care at this point?
We know what song it's going to be. It's going to be like, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
It's going to be surf music.
Patrick Stewart came out a couple days later. Patrick Stewart came out and said,
oh, that sounds like a marvelous idea. I would love to do that film. I've always wanted to work with Quentin.
I think
and I was like, Patrick, really?
Can me and Ian be in it together?
I think that's the first I heard of this.
Oh,
was like,
Lord.
Okay, if the two of them were in it, but the captain of the ship they were on was Samuel Jackson, and...
Okay, Ben, keep
it's
going.
Becoming, yeah.
I was that's the first I heard of it though. When I saw a headline saying Patrick Stewart wants to be in Quentin Tarantino's Star Trek movie, and I'm like, well, that sounds like fun. That's all I have.
Okay,
to say
but I was like, all right. So the selling point is not going to be about the world that Star Trek once tried to inscribe for us. The selling point is going to be, oh, we're going to. I don't know. We're gonna do something rude with Star Trek, or we're gonna push those boundaries that everybody else has been pushing.
Maybe it'll be like a big screen Star Trek Elseworld movie, or maybe they're just understanding that the last couple movies in the new reboot weren't really all that great, so they got to try to do something drastically different now. R-rated movies are the big thing these days.
Yeah. Well, and I can. all well and good, but I couldn't tell you what the new reboot is like because I only got to see the one pilot because I can't afford to pay for another platform and watch the new
Discovery. I was talking about the TV show. I was talking about the movie.
Well, I'm starting to look at them as similar products anymore because the production value on the first episode of Discovery I saw was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Not a TV show. This was to my mind, this was a cinematic level spectacle.
Like an HBO show.
Precisely. Yeah. Which, you know, is on a par with film, or, you know, cinematic filmmaking.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of TV shows, what? Nicole, what's coming to Netflix?
She-Ra.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's coming to Netflix.
A whole new She-Ra?
Yeah.
And it's going, who's working on it?
Noel Stevenson, who is a co-creator behind Lumberjanes.
All right.
So it's going to be amazing because you know what?
Is it live action or animated?
Oh, it's animated.
Okay.
It's going to have so much stuff about friendship, which is my favorite thing ever. Wait, hold on. I wasn't ready.
I
was like almost ready, but not quite ready.
Well, pull that up. While you're pulling that up, we'll come back to She-Ra. In the meantime, Alita Battle Angel is coming out. Now,
everybody looks at me.
I always thought it was
obviously.
Yes.
I always thought it was Battle Angel Alita. Am I getting that wrong?
Yeah, well, it's Battle Angel Alita the first time it came to the States. It's called like Gundam over in Japan.
Yeah.
So whatever they're calling it for the movie, it's whatever. They didn't know.
Alita colon Battle Angel.
Yeah, that's just
colon whatever. Battle Angel colon.
Exactly.
I saw the trailer for it earlier today, and I remember a comment you made on Facebook where they did the manga eyes to the lead actress, which I thought it was interesting because she was the only one they did that effect on.
Exactly.
I just glimpsed at the trailer. Is it live action, essentially?
It's live action.
Okay.
It is.
I thought it was all CG.
She's basically all CG.
There's a lot of CG in that movie, though.
But it's not... It didn't make my eyes bleed.
No, look good.
Yeah, it's this
Robert
is why
Rodriguez.
Yeah,
sure.
This is why Avatar happens so that this would look good. It's one of those things. I'm not broken on the eyes. I'm actually kind of, it could go 50-50 for me. A lot of people are like, ooh, Uncanny Valley. But the thing is, I think that's on purpose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think they want you to feel a little like, ooh, I don't know how to feel about this character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a very uncomfortable world, and there's going to be a lot of, if they do it right, there's going to be a lot of talk about what's consciousness, what counts as human, what counts as somebody that gets rights.
Yeah.
So differentiating her that way is an interesting step.
Cool.
I think.
And it also has Mahershala Ali in it, who played one of my favorite Marvel villains, Cottonmouth, in the Luke Cage series.
Mm.
So I'm looking forward to that.
I like him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Christoph Waltz.
And Christoph Waltz, of course. How can I forget?
Yeah, I think he's going to be good in that role.
It's like really good casting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So coming back to She-Ra, Nicole, tell us more about it.
Yeah, so here's a pull quote about the full description from Netflix and DreamWorks. The trailblazing girl power icon originally debuted in 1985 to satisfy overwhelming demand for a female lead fantasy series. With Stevenson's unique voice at the helm, fans are in store for an epic and timely tale that celebrates female friendship and empowerment led by a warrior princess tailor-made for today. So not really much more than I said, but female friendship.
Friendship.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And there's some interesting characters in the She-Ra realm. Like Hordak is my favorite. He's really good, and he's got a lot of like really bad ladies around him, like a scorpion lady, a cat lady, and a shadow woman who's like all in a cloak. And so there's like a lot of like, I want to use bad words, but bad BBs.
I'm already bleeping.
Yeah, I know, right? And Chris,
I said a bad word.
Chris had mentioned that there's like just one guy, and he's got like hearts on his armor and stuff. Yeah, that's like totally like a guy that works by her side.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he looks like he could potentially be very gay. So, and it's Noel Stevenson, so there's a chance that he could be canonically very gay.
And if this is Netflix, they'll be like, we'll go for it.
It'll be great. And he just like in the back being like, you go, girl.
What was Hordak had a guy with him that had eyeballs on eye stalks that would like go up?
Yeah,
what was
I can't remember his name offhand. It's been a while since I've watched the original. I have like the box sets, but they're like really dry. Like if you rewatch those, they're
Filmation, right?
Oh, they're kind of painful. They look great and they're lovely,
but
like
set of like Filmation's Flash Gordon. And and I still have never been able to watch them all.
It's hard.
Because so much of the animated sequences are recycled, and the stories are recycled.
Yeah.
And, you know, because they mass produce these things, and they weren't really made with a high-end aesthetic.
No.
I mean, the worlds and stuff are really cool. So sure. I think this is a really good, really good
is
thing.
There a release date for
Not
Shiva?
That I saw. There, just, Netflix is going to be churning out like a chunk of things, like a Troll TV show and
Troll Hunter 2,
and they're gonna do three seasons altogether, or two seasons altogether. There's the Trolls thing. Let's see here. Yeah, it just says we'll bring you more on She-Ra's Return when we learn it. So these things have just been announced that they're going to be
right.
Yeah, like just yesterday. Yeah.
Probably sometime late 2018, early 2019. Stay tuned for that. All right, cool. Hey, friends, let's move on to Book Report, and let's start with you, Cole. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I want to talk about a book that I really don't want to talk about.
You don't have to talk about it.
Well, but
that one, yeah.
Where we're recording three episodes tonight, I brought three books to talk about. So
don't tell them how the pudding is made.
I hit on this. If you had the benefit of seeing the live show, I went on my little rant there before we got rolling on the fun and games. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Doomsday Clock, DC's morally dubious decision to produce a 12-issue sequel to Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' groundbreaking New York Times best-selling graphic novel, Watchmen. In case you're not very familiar with this, Geoff Johns is writing the story, and it's penned by in all sincerity, the very, very talented Gary Frank. The premise is essentially, it takes place a couple of years after the close of the original story. And thanks to a series of unfortunate events, the journal that forgive me, I may spoil some things for you for the original Watchmen, and I will definitely spoil things for you for this.
All right,
first
Watchmen
issue.
Spoilers coming up. Thank you, Cole.
So, if you recall from the original Watchmen, if you've read the book, essentially everybody dies except for Night Owl and Saturn Girl. Dr. Manhattan goes away, leaves the Earth, but people like Ozymandias and Rorschach and all the other characters die off. Well, the story opens.
Ozymandias didn't die off.
He didn't?
No.
Nope, you're right. Yes. Okay. And then there was the squid. Yeah, you're right. He didn't die. I remember everybody dying. I need to read it again.
And then the squid.
The squid. So this book, the story is set, I can't tell you precisely how many years after. It's set in 1992. I can't remember when the original one was set.
In the 80s?
That was when it was written, but I don't know if that's when the story was actually set. I thought it was in...
I thought it was supposed to be in the 80s.
I thought it was in the 80s.
Yeah. Okay.
Because Nixon, like, pushed his... he added terms or something like
okay.
that.
Okay. So, all right. So... Yeah. At the ending of the original story, we discover that Rorschach's journal has been left at a tabloid newspaper because he knows he's not going to survive the conflict with Ozymandias. So, and the book opens with excerpts from the journal. Guess what? Someone found the journal and discovered that the whole squid monster plot to bring unity to the warring countries was all a ruse. And we go from there. And then we find out that... someone masquerading as Rorschach, pardon the pun, is alive, but we realize that it's not really Rorschach because at one point he takes off his glove and he clearly has dark skin. And then we meet Ozymandias and he's dying of a brain tumor. This is all, you know, all well and good and interesting stuff, but the thing that is most troubling for me is that this story is meant to merge this the Watchmen universe with the DC universe, and as I snarkily said in at the live show, now Batman and Superman can be super friends with Rorschach and Dr. Manhattan. To quote Alan Moore, when they did the prequels to The Watchmen, he said, "I just want more than anything for this not to happen." And after reading this book, I am of that mindset. This is just, to me, this is a terrible money grab. Now, I respect the fact that I am going to read like a grumpy old man and that I am sort of, you know, holding on to my attitude about the original book and where it fit into my life when I originally read it and where it fed into where it rested in comic book history, that to me it had some legitimacy because it was most assuredly a satire reflecting back on the toxic masculinity and other things of superhero comics. And I think that's something that's been lost in the retelling of this story and the reinscription of this story. Maybe not. Chris, did you have a comment you want to make?
I was going to make some minor defenses when you were done, when you were completely
okay.
done.
So all right. So my point,
Mr. Hornaday, you may proceed.
Okay. Well, I need to wrap up, but I'm going to keep reading it because I'm curious where it's going to go. Here's the thing, and here's why I'm offended by it being a money grab, is that if for a publisher that prides themselves on taking risks and being groundbreaking, of hiring the best of artists and writers, then why not tell something new? Why not give us a new story? We are living in a really frightening sociopolitical time, and it is a perfect climate for artists to step up and reflect on that. Why borrow from the work of someone else that doesn't need to be borrowed from? Because that's just so obviously a commercial ploy. Chris, go.
Mr. Casso, your rebuttal?
I actually agree with that part completely, okay. Other than Marvel and DC will never be the companies to do what you want. Go read Black Mask.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, and these defenses aren't because I want to defend, because okay. I sure as heck am not going to buy this, but I will say we don't know for a fact they're going to merge the universes.
Okay.
And something to keep in mind is that this is, we sold 91 copies in 2 days. Mm-hmm. I sold 98 copies of Marvel Legacy in like 3 months. So this is going to help a lot of stores. So that's a factor
sure.
to keep in mind.
The book is good for business.
It's good for business. And I think I forgot one of the things I was going to reply to. But yeah, no, I agree. There's no need to go back and data mine this stuff. I just heard they're going to, that one of the Marvel books just brought, or will be bringing back the Sentry again. It's like, leave him dead.
Yeah.
So I'm just not a fan of data mining this stuff so hard, you know, and it makes me sad. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, it's well crafted.
Yes,
it's beautifully drawn, and I think it's well written.
I think it's...
So I think if you're hearing the opinions, you know, and you're not feeling the same way, it might be something you want to check out because of the craftsmanship that's been put into it. Anytime they've brought any Watchmen stuff back, they've mm-hmm. actually put some money into the creative teams.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I've found mm-hmm. so there's at least that.
All right,
cool.
Yeah.
I disagree on the writing. I think I think Geoff Johns is a hack. I don't think he brings anything new to the table. But as I said, I think, in all sincerity, I think Gary Frank is a brilliant artist, and I respect the fact artists got to pay their bills and they got to put food on the table. But I'm always going to get on my high horse about art and literature and those things. But in 20, 30 years, this may be looked back upon as something significant in how in a post-structuralist or post-modern popular entertainment noosphere, it represented something important, and it might. I don't know if I want to live that long.
All right, doomsday clock. Thank you, Cole. Let's
You're
move
welcome.
On. Nicole, what do you want to tell us
so
about?
So why don't we talk about drug addiction
Let's
and all-age material,
oh,
shall
boy.
We?
Sounds a lot more fun than
okay.
doomsday.
The book that I'm going to be reviewing is Sunny Side Up. It's by Scholastic, who also publishes Bone and Amulet and a bunch of other great things, Raina Telgemeier stuff. And this is written by Jennifer L. Holm and Michael Holm. And written and drawn by, I believe. I thought there was another person on here. Oh, yeah, with color by Lark Pien. So this follows a girl named Sunny. She's packed off to Florida to go stay with her grandfather for the summer. And as you start reading the story, it's interspersed with periods from her past as she's experiencing the summer. So you get to slowly get this picture of her family life. And she has an older brother. She's got some other siblings. And the brother seems to have a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol, and he's cutting up a lot. And meanwhile, she's in Florida, and she is bored to death. She's in one of those, like, retirement home communities where it's just, like, you know, it's just all a bunch of old people. And like her grandfather is kind of like a ladies' man and like all this stuff, but you know, and he's hiding cigarettes and everything. So there's like these fun quirks to his own personality. But in the meantime, like Sunny's just bored. So she meets a young boy, like the only other young person in the area. And like she learns about comics, like, and there's little parts about Spider-Man and Hulk and stuff like that. But it's really interesting because all she wants to do is have fun and kind of get away and avoid the fact that there's this awful thing happening in her family. She's about 10 years old while this is all happening. And as you read through it, you get like how much pressure and how hard this has actually been on her. And it's really well crafted. There is also a sequel to this that I haven't read yet. But there's a note in the back from Jennifer and Matthew. And it's talking about writing the book so that young readers who are facing the same problems don't have to feel ashamed like the creators. It's kind of semi-autobiographical because they experienced something similar to of like a family member when they were young and they didn't quite know how to deal with it. So, you know, it's just, you know, it's okay to feel sad and confused and need some help. It's definitely okay to talk about it. And it's a surprisingly just really well done book. I think it's you could add this to Smile and Babysitter's Club and different things that take on different things that people are experiencing. And yeah, I would highly recommend this book. It's $12.99. It's same sort of size as, you know, all the other graphic novels of Scholastic's work. And I think it's really important. It's a really important piece to have in the comic book world and to have accessible to young readers.
Yeah. Sunny's head up. Thank you, Nicole. And finally, Chris Casso, what do you got for us?
I read a manga, surprise, surprise. A Polar Bear in Love by Koromo, and it's published by Yen Press. And basically, it follows a polar bear that comes across a young seal and decides that he loves him completely. Oh. And I promise I'll make you happy. Once you grow up, let's get married. And the seal's just like, but I'm a male too. And they're like, huh, well, I don't have a problem with that. I don't mind. the best part about the whole... So there's not really a plot. Like, that's the plot. That's
so is
it.
This technically all-age boys' love?
Yes, it basically is. And but... It's great because the seal lives in utter terror every panel of the comic because he thinks that the bear is just like reeling him in to kill him. Oh. And you get things from the seal's point of view and like the bear is in like dark shadow and like he's plotting against him. But the bear actually truly loves him and really wants to have a life with him and gets to meet his mother. And you just kind of get like these... A mixture of happiness and sadness throughout the book, which is kind of great because the bear had a tough life. His mother abandoned him. He was adopted by another bear, and that bear died. And then he met a whale and made friends with the whale, but then the whale died. And
so all he wants love and companionship.
But you get great parts where like there's a seagull that's like watching this whole thing, and he's like, "You're gonna eat him, right? Because I need to eat what you leave behind." And wow. and the polar bear's like, "No, don't bother us." And
can't take our love from us.
Exactly. And the seal's beginning to kind of get the idea that like he's genuine about this, but he's still like in utter terror consistently. So it's a lot of fun. It's a pretty brief read. I get the feeling these were weekly installments in some other magazine over in Japan and they just merged them together. So if you're just looking for some quick light reading, this is highly recommended.
It doesn't look like light reading.
It gets kind of dramatic in some places. And there's actually enough little bit of story in there that'll keep you busy for a bit. So, yeah,
cool.
Recommend it.
A Polar Bear in Love. Thank you, Chris. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show, and coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound Podcast is brought to you by the Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, where you can find the new episode, EasyCom, EasyCo.
I have forgotten.
As well as Comic Extension here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsengine.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, your questions come to us from me.
Yay!
We've discussed speculation about John Hamm taking over Batman from Ben Affleck. He might not get it, but let's pretend he doesn't. Here are five questions about actors who thought they were getting a superhero role but were eventually passed over.
Mm.
Number one, this Godfather alum was considered for the role of Superman in Richard Donner's 1978 film, a role which, of course, went to Christopher Reeve. This person passed on the role saying, quote, "There's no way I'm getting into that silly suit." He had no problem getting into another silly suit for 1990s Dick Tracy. And no, I'm not talking about Al Pacino.
Warren Beatty.
No, it's not Warren Beatty.
Really?
Nope.
I can't remember anybody else in Dick Tracy except for Madonna.
Yeah.
It was Al Pacino and Warren Beatty. And who else got in a silly suit?
James Caan, who played Spaldoni.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. The suit wasn't really that silly, but, you know, still, it's 1990s Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
All right, number two. When Jack Nicholson was hesitant about committing for the role of the Joker in Tim Burton's 1989 Batman, the producers offered the role to this actor-comedian. When he accepted, the producers then went back to Nicholson, told him they were giving the role to someone else, whereupon Jack finally accepted. What late comedian was used as bait for Jack Nicholson?
I want to say, like, just for fun, Bill Hicks. I don't know.
No, although Bill Hicks would have been great. No, it was Robin Williams.
Oh, right.
He resented being used as bait and refused to work for Warner Brothers again until they apologized.
He would have been more of like a Riddler, I think.
He was offered the role of the Riddler, but he was like, nope, I'm not working with you guys.
Okay.
The role which eventually went to Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Number three, 2002's Spider-Man, of course, went to Tobey Maguire. This actor was originally considered for the role, but don't cry for him, as his other movies released in 2002 include Gangs of New York and Catch Me If You Can.
Oh, DiCaprio?
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio was originally going to be Spider-Man.
Ooh,
wow.
All right.
No.
Number four, Edward Norton is famous for rewriting films he's starring in, and 2008's Hulk is no exception.
Hmm.
Had this former X-Files actor been cast, I want to believe Hulk would have been a better film.
Really? Duchovny?
Yeah, David Duchovny.
Is that right?
Yeah. Mark Ruffalo was also considered and, of course, would take over the role in The Avengers.
Yeah.
And finally, number five, 2008's Iron Man kickstarted the current Marvel Cinematic Universe with Robert Downey Jr. in the titular role.
It's been a long podcast, Ben.
Had this actor been cast, as was initially considered, fans might have confused him for his other superhero role, thinking Iron Man's suit was actually made of adamantium.
Oh, Hugh Jackman?
Yeah, Hugh Jackman.
Interesting.
I'm surprised you didn't have anything about Nicolas Cage's Superman here.
Yeah.
I did look that up. Yeah. I did look that up. Yeah. There was going to be another whole thing. Maybe I'll include that in a different time kind of quiz time. Actors who undergo drastic facial reconstruction for a role. All right. Well, that is quiz time, and that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Nice.